Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm John McCoy, and with me is returning host Shannon Camp.
Hi, I'm so excited to be back.
Hi, Shannon. By now, people should know who you are and what you do, but can you repeat it one more time?
I'm a moderator of the Sophomore Lit Facebook group, and I rule it with an iron fist. That's all anyone needs to know about me.
We are doing a very short story this time that Shannon suggested, and I'm very grateful for you suggesting it, Shannon, because I need some short works here to keep to a schedule. And you want to say which one it is?
This is Roald Dahl's Lamb to the Slaughter.
And I was fascinated to hear that this was a story you did in high school. And then I found out that, like, everybody does this in high school. I feel like, what kind of high school did I go to? I missed out all the salacious, all the nasty, all the really juicy stories.
I feel like all the anthologized short stories that are really popular are really either violent or twisted, like An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge, the one where the man is out on a ledge in a city and he's like thinking about plummeting to his death. I don't remember what that one is called. The Lottery, which we've talked about before on this show. Yeah, like The Most Dangerous Game.
So many of the stories you read for class fit into the twist ending story. And I think that they were trying really hard to get kids to be interested.
Yeah, it makes sense. I get it.
I also think that those kinds of stories were really, really popular. Starting around Ambrose Bierce and going down into the post-war period. And then somewhere along the line, Raymond Carver came along and everybody wanted to be him. And now nobody writes stories with twist endings anymore.
I feel like there's something really satisfying for young people, too, about any work of fiction that ends with, like, a button. You know what I mean?
Right.
None of us want to read about Nick Carraway's boats being borne ceaselessly back into the past. Kids don't like the ending of The Great Gatsby. You know what I mean? Like, kids, teens, I think there is something to be said about, like, ending on a note of, like, hey, wow, you know, gee whiz.
Kids are also going to be very scandalized reading Roald Dahl, having grown up reading Charlie and the Chocolate Factory when I was young, Matilda by the time you came along, and then suddenly being confronted with one of his adult stories. And of course, Dahl wrote these stories before he wrote his children's books, mostly. I mean, I think he kept writing them, but there's something quite alarming and quite fascinating about reading a book by someone that you only knew from their children's books.
Here's the thing. Uh-oh. It's sort of surprising until you think about Roald Dahl for like 30 seconds, maybe less, because growing up, I was a huge Roald Dahl fan. But let's take a moment and actually look at some of his works that qualify as children's literature. And, you know, I'm using heavy air quotes here. The twits, they end up getting, like, glued to the ceiling, right? To just suffer there for all eternity. Who could forget the little boy and the witches being turned into a mouse permanently? Which I know myself and a lot of other children found pretty shocking. Even in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, there's an implication that if they don't, you know, sort the children's problems out in time, that they'll be faced with serious peril and or, you know, bodily horror for the rest of their lives. So I had a very, very sheltered childhood. Like, I was thinking about the first time I read Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. My dad sat down and got out the book And he turned to my brother and me and said, "Now, at first, it's going to seem like Charlie's not going to get a golden ticket, and you're going to be sad, but it's okay. He gets it. So we're just going to keep reading."
You had the Princess Bride happen in real life.
Yes. Yeah. Like, it was very much like a kind of bubble of sorts. I do remember the experience of reading it in class and being like, "Whoa, this is so cool. She killed her husband," because I was like 14. But I don't think I found it particularly shocking that it was by Roald Dahl.
This is a story that when you suggested it to me, I realized I hadn't read the story, but I knew everything that happened in this story. It's like a story that I had heard of. And I think I may have seen the Alfred Hitchcock Presents adaptation of it.
Yeah.
So as you mentioned, it's a story of murder. Let's go over really quickly here. It's only what, like 10 pages long. Anyway, you can read it in probably 15, 20 minutes, or less, depending on how much you want to luxuriate in the prose. So the story is that 6-month pregnant, devoted 50s housewife, Mary Maloney, can't wait for her husband, who is a police officer, his name is Patrick, to come home.
Heart to tar. I am an American police officer, and I am an Irishman.
Yes, that's about the level of characterization we get from the story too. Patrick comes home. She wants him to come home so she can dote on him, but when he does, all is not well. He gets drunk and tells her that he wants a divorce. Pointedly, Dahl doesn't explain his reasons for that. Mary wants to cook Patrick a frozen leg of lamb as a peace offering. Patrick wants to leave. So, of course, what she does is she whacks him over the head with a roast, killing him instantly.
But she's sort of in like a fugue state.
She's in a Walter White fugue state. That's a great way of putting it. I thought this took place in Britain because they say she knew what they did to killers, and they hanged people in Britain up till like the 1980s. I guess they killed people in America though too. So either way, she's ready to face the music for herself, but she doesn't want her baby to get killed. So she decides that she's going to come up with a plan really quickly. She puts the roast into the oven. She goes off to the grocery for some vegetables, and when she gets back, she puts on her best, "Oh my God, my husband is dead" face and calls the cops. And they're all Patrick's friends. They come over. The medical examiner says...
"Faith and Bigora, it's one of me colleagues."
And he says, "Oh, it's a club. Look for it." And, of course, they're a bunch of bumbling police officers. They have no idea. And Mary pulls out the roast after someone smells it and serves it to the people, and it ends with them all saying, "I wouldn't be surprised if the weapon was somewhere right here under our noses." And if you watch the Alfred Hitchcock Presents version of this, this actually ends with like a little wah, 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 wah. So that's where we end, and it's a happy ending for everyone, I guess, except for Patrick. So it's a very, very slight story. Long before I ever read, you know, I had ever heard of the story, I had heard of this plot device of someone hitting someone with a frozen roast and then cooking it.
Isn't there also like a famous riddle about like there's a man, he's hanging, there's no chair underneath him, but there's a puddle of water. How did he do it? He was standing right on a block of ice and then the ice melted.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. It's that kind of, but it's the mystery taken to its essence. There's like no, I suppose we're supposed to be sympathetic to Mary, in as much as she does seem like a devoted wife who does seem to be absolutely blindsided by this. It couldn't have been that great a marriage if she didn't see this coming. But Patrick has no personality to speak of. Anything that could give him personality is elided over in that indirect narrative. The police officers have no personality.
I feel like Mary sort of, more than she is a character, she just is a symbolic mother. Like, she's a very idealized, like, Madonna-esque female type at the beginning of the story. She's pregnant. She's created, like, this really cozy home. The opening sentence of the story is, I think, the room was warm, which, like, immediately brings to mind sort of, like, a womb-type image for me. And it talks about how she, like, when her husband comes home, she just wants to, like, sit in silence and, like, bask in the warmth of his energy, like a plant to the sun. Everything is sort of nature-based, and she's pregnant. So that's what she did for me. It wasn't, like, who she was. It was what she was.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And there is a sort of a proto-critique here of the role of women in the domestic sphere, the terror of being left alone when you're pregnant, when there's absolutely nowhere for her to go or anything for her to do, the fact that she's completely thrown herself into, unquestioningly, into the role of mother and provider and caregiver, and she's being treated so poorly. There's a kind of a critique here, but I don't know, knowing more about Dahl, I don't know that it's that. I don't think there's any political angle to that. I think that it's just he's playing it up for the patheticness of it.
I was going to say, to me, like, I can smell the Lucky Strikes when I read this story, you know? It's a time capsule. It, like, it's so archetypal of the era in which Dahl, you know, like, came into his own as an adult. You have, like, this is what a woman is, and this is what a man does. And, like, it's like, I don't even know how to explain it in a more eloquent way than that. I don't think Dahl is, like, making any sort of a feminist stand. I think it's more likely, especially considering that we read that this story may or may not have been inspired by an idea by Ian Fleming, that it's like, watch your back, that wife's gonna get ya.
Yeah, the other thing that this suggests to me is the shock of the story is that Mary is capable of killing her husband. And that's presented as a kind of a real shock. And it's telling to me that that this was adapted by Alfred Hitchcock, because post-war thrillers and crime fictions really focused on this idea that people are just on the verge of being able to commit atrocities. You know, before that, you know, if you go back to horror stories and thriller stories from before the war and going back into the 19th century, it was always either there was like a horrible monster that you were afraid of in a thriller, or criminals belonged to a degenerate class. They belonged to sort of the underclass. After around this time, the 50s, I think about, again, you know, Psycho and other stories by Hitchcock, and then the writing of Patricia Highsmith or something like that. There's this emphasis on the idea that we're all capable of doing something awful, and even like really low trash culture, like the Tales from the Crypt comics from this time, were all stories about people who had like one bad day and they end up disemboweling their spouse.
Been there.
I mean, I think there's a way in which this is a bit of maybe Freud coming up, you know, into the popular culture at the time. Maybe I'm reaching for something here.
No, I see that. Yeah, I don't know a ton about Freud, so I can't give you like specific examples as backup. But there's definitely, if Dahl was trying to say anything, then one assumes the statement he was trying to make was about power dynamics in a relationship. That's what it seems like to me. That's where the tension is. You know, Patrick has all the power.
And there's also the way in which she is able to take those things that might seem to be disadvantages, that the typical, the inability to hide her emotions, her own frailty, and use that to confuse the police. She doesn't have to create an alibi for herself. She just has to kind of
be herself.
Push aside. Yeah, she is herself, and that's how she gets away with it.
"Listen," he said, "I've got something to tell you." "What is it, darling? What's the matter?" He became absolutely motionless, and he kept his head down. "This is going to be a big shock to you, I'm afraid," he said. "But I've thought about it a good deal, and I've decided the only thing to do is to tell you immediately." And he told her. It didn't take long, 4 or 5 minutes at most, and she sat still through it all, watching him with puzzled horror. "So there it is," he added. "I know it's a tough time to be telling you this, but there simply wasn't any other way. Of course, I'll give you money, and I'll see that you're taken care of, but there really shouldn't be any problem. I hope not, in any case. It wouldn't be very good for my job." Her first instinct was to not believe any of it. She thought perhaps she'd imagined the whole thing. Perhaps, if she acted as though she had not heard him, she would find out that none of it had ever happened. "I'll fix some supper," she whispered. When she walked across the room, she couldn't feel her feet touching the floor. She couldn't feel anything except for a slight sickness. She did everything without thinking. She went downstairs to the freezer and took hold of the first object she found. She lifted it out and looked at it. It was wrapped in paper, so she took off the paper and looked at it again. A leg of lamb. All right, then. They would have lamb for supper. She carried it upstairs, held the thin end with both of her hands, went into the living room, and saw him standing by the window with his back to her, and stopped. "I've already told you," he said. "Don't make supper for me. I'm going out." At that point, Mary Maloney simply walked up behind him, and without any pause, she swung the big frozen leg of lamb high in the air and brought it down as hard as she could on the back of his head. She might as well have hit him with a steel bar.
Okay, hi guys. Welcome back. If you notice a sudden abrupt change in tone of our voices or our demeanors, it's because the back half of this podcast ran into some audio difficulties. So we thought we would save the good 20 minutes we had, and we'll just pick up talking more about Roald Dahl. We ask that you forgive us if we repeat anything we just said, but it's been about, I don't know, a week and a half since we recorded the first part. Hi, Shannon. You're welcome back.
Hi. I feel like we both aged 10 years. And you look it, honey.
It has been a little rough time to, in the in-between time. So let's all be extra nice to each other as we discuss Dahl, the most quintessentially mean of children's book authors.
Yeah, everyone's favorite cuddly author, Roald Dahl.
So I'm not sure where we left off. You the listener, know where we left off, but I think I had just made some pithy comment about this short story being the emergence of Freudian ideas into the mainstream, and something about the way in which it strikes me that a lot of stories from this time dealt with people doing horrible things, good people doing horrible things because they had a bad day. And we can just take it from here. I don't think we have to necessarily pick up from where we left off.
What am I supposed to jump off from your monologue about Freud? You monster. I'm hanging up on you. What was that?
Well, as Shannon pulls the roast leg of lamb out of the freezer, we'll just talk about Dahl in a larger sense here, because we all grew up reading Dahl.
I would say that I don't, in the grand spectrum of children's books authors, I don't find it particularly surprising that Roald Dahl is the one who has tiptoed more into adult writing, because his children's books are already so incredibly dark and gruesome, especially like The Witches, the little boy gets turned into a mouse and doesn't get turned back, which traumatizing to a lot of children, including myself. There's the famous example of The Twits and many, many others. So there is an optimism in his works, but there's also a great deal of cynicism as well. So I don't know that Lamb to the Slaughter feels like that much of a departure.
Probably not. This was written in the 50s, I think, at Lamb to the Slaughter, and Dahl's great children's books were from the 60s and 70s mostly. I agree, but Dahl gets credited for being a kind of a mean children's author, but as I recall from our earlier conversation, the one that you, dear listener, will never hear, we talked a little bit about other authors that were kind of rough in childhood, and you brought up a lot of like 19th century authors that you thought were kind of...
Oh yeah, definitely. I think back then, when there were so few books that were being created for the purpose of being for children, there was even more of a blurred line between what constitutes youth literature and what constitutes adult literature. I think of things like the darkness of the original Peter Pan novel by J.M. Barrie, which just has, like, speaking of Freudian, I mean, that one really takes the cake, casting of the stage versions aside. I was thinking about The Wizard of Oz, and the copy that I checked out from my library when I was a kid had a very detailed watercolor illustration of the Tin Man throwing bloody, dismembered wolf parts off a cliff because he chops up wolves with an axe. And there's lots of other violent things that happen in that book. But I think most in connection with Roald Dahl's work, I think actually of the work of Frances Hodgson Burnett, because she also has these sort of wicked child characters who have to learn a lesson, and there's often like magical adults who come into their lives and teach them something. But yeah, those are books where there's some incredibly dark stuff in those. In The Secret Garden, Mary's entire household dies of like a yellow fever. I'm afraid I don't remember exactly what the disease was, and they like find her among the bodies when they go looking at the house. And then of course in, oh gosh, A Little Princess, I almost said The Princess Diaries. In A Little Princess, Captain Crewe, the heroine's father, dies, and she's left destitute to be starved and abused by the people who run her posh girls' school.
A lot of people who criticize Dahl, at least his children's books, are taken aback by what they see as his arbitrary moralism in a book like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, where he literally wants to punish children for chewing gum or for watching too much TV or things like that. But I don't know that Dahl really, in the end, was much of a moralizer. Certainly, Lamb to the Slaughter doesn't have a moral compass to it. It's more that we as readers are, if we find it enjoyable, we're charmed by the ingeniousness of the plot, and nobody ends up learning a lesson, I think, from Lamb to the Slaughter. And I would also argue that nobody ends up learning a lesson in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory either. I think any morality that Wonka might teach is kind of blown away by his admitted hypocrisy over certain things. There's, especially in the second book, The Great Glass Elevator, people call him out all the time. They were constantly asking, like, well, why do you do even in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, they ask, why do you make gum in your factory if you don't want people to chew it? And he says, oh, I'm going a little deaf. And
I'm a capitalist.
And I think that Dahl belongs more to the tradition of the people who made fun of Victorian moralism. And I think that in that way, he reminded me most of Lewis Carroll, who's in Alice in Wonderland. Almost every single poem in that book is a parody of an existing Victorian moral instructional poem for children. And it seems like Carroll didn't like mixing morality in his stories any more than Dahl did. And so I think that's a kind of a subtle point, but that's one I've gotten more attuned to reading Dahl as an adult. Maybe I just want him to be that way because I don't like moralism in children's books either.
No, I definitely agree with that. I would say the only issue I take with any of that is that I don't think it's about punishing Violet for chewing gum. I think it's about punishing her for being obnoxious and self-centered. And I don't think it's about like punishing Mike for watching TV. It's about punishing him for being vacuous and, again, self-absorbed. But I agree, although I would say I feel like Roald Dahl doesn't really paint in shades of gray. Everyone is like black and white because, not to say this too much, but in our last conversation, we talked about some of the more hideous character he's created, the Trunchbull, the Twits, Mr. Wormwood among them. But I would say for every one of those characters, you have someone like Miss Honey, who is just so purely good that it's almost like swinging the pendulum completely in the other direction in terms of not being totally three-dimensional. But I feel that it's more about what these characters represent to children, like good teacher, bad teacher, good parent, bad parent, friend, foe, that really makes the stories resonate as much as they do. The fact that they are very archetypal in some ways.
Yeah, the one thing that does get rewarded in Dahl all the time is ingenuity and cleverness and being able to make the best of a bad situation. And in that way, Lamb to the Slaughter is a typical Dahl story in that the protagonist, we root for the protagonist because she thinks on her feet. And we're supposed to be satisfied with the ending, not because we think justice has been served, but because we like to see a clever person outsmart a stupid person. And I think that happens all the time in Dahl's books. Matilda certainly is an ingenious child. And there even is that Miss Honey talks to Matilda's father in one point of that book and says something about how he shouldn't despise clever people because someday he will need a clever person to be on his side.
I agree. I totally agree about like the idea of cleverness overcoming ignorance. I think that's a theme in every single one of his books, right down to the really short ones like The Fantastic Mr. Fox, where the clever animals outwit the nasty, stupid farmer. But I would also say there's a recurring theme of the powerless overcoming the powerful. And that's true in Lamb to the Slaughter, where the patriarchy has all the power. Not only is her husband in every traditional sense of the word, but he's also literally a police officer, which has that like extra kind of arm of the law feeling. And she, as a lowly woman with no job, has no social standing and ends up kind of, you know, throwing off the, I don't know what to say, throwing off his disdain, finally one-upping him in those last moments, and also then, of course, tricking all the cops. And I think, yeah, just like in his children's work, it's often so literal. Things like the tiny little boy from The Witches who gets turned into a mouse overcoming a huge horde of witches. It's probably a little more subtle in his adult stories, but there's something incredibly satisfying as a reader about, you know, seeing a power balance shift like that.
To underscore that, Dahl spends a lot of time working on the patheticness of his characters in the sense of they're brought really low before they can be brought high. Charlie Bucket and his family are starving when he finally gets a golden ticket.
Yeah, that's what makes it feel like a Burnett parody.
In our last conversation, again, the one that is now...
We promised we'd never speak of it.
The one that is rests now with kings and counselors. We talked a little bit about when I read Dahl as a teenager and I found his adult stories, I felt like, oh, wow, this is some big secret out there that Dahl wrote these nasty books for adults. And that was a kind of a moment of, I don't know, growth as a reader, or if I don't know if you would call it growth, because I searched out his awful story, My Uncle Oswald, which I really cannot disrecommend enough. Do not read this novel. Did you have this experience of reading an author's adult work after having read their children's work and finding it scandalizing or at least surprising?
I don't know that I've encountered that many like works by authors I read as a kid. There are authors I read whose works kind of straddle the world between childhood and adulthood, whose work definitely matures through the series. I mean, I guess to hear my most shocked experience, listeners should go back and listen to our episode about Judy Blume's Forever, .. because it's a far cry from Super Fudge. And I think I did share, too, that as a kid, I was totally disgusted and frightened by the cover to Shel Silverstein's work of adult poetry. The name of it is escaping me right now, but it's two prisoners chained hand and foot to the wall, and they're totally naked. And the title is, one prisoner is saying to the other, "Now here's my plan." The title of the book is "Now Here's My Plan." And I remember seeing that with Shel Silverstein's other books and being like, as a kid, being like, ah, but I don't know that I've encountered that many children's authors as an adult.
Well, there's also the backwards that that can happen, where you can come across a book by an author that you think of primarily as a adult reader, and you find, oh, they wrote a children's book. James Thurber wrote a wonderful children's book called The 12 Clocks, which I actually do recommend everyone go out and read. That's Neil Gaiman's favorite book in the world. And I read that only after I had read a lot of James Thurber's adult works, and I love it more than anything that he's ever done. So that was great. Or if you go back and read Oscar Wilde's children's stories, the Selfish Giant and The Happy Prince, although those are extremely sad books, so, you know, do it alone in your room where you can weep openly.
I think I more commonly have the experience of returning to books I read as a child that are aimed towards children, and only as an adult understanding the darkness within them. Mm. That sounds so emo, but you know what I mean. Understanding the more bittersweet moments, the more nuanced character aspects, the things that were kind of written between the lines. Examples like Peter Pan and all like the sadness of what it would be to be a kid forever. Like when I read that book as a child, I was just like, yippee, take me away to Neverland. But then rereading it, it's like, it brings me to tears. It's so incredibly sad. And I definitely would love to talk about another author whose work I found a lot more disturbing when I went back and read it as an adult, Lewis Sacker, or is it Satcher, who I feel may be one of the most natural predecessors to Roald Dahl's work. Especially his sideways stories from Wayside School often feature naughty children getting punished via supernatural and very bizarre and kind of gross methods. But his book, Holes, is maybe the most powerful young adult novel about institutionalized racism. And when I read that in the third grade, it completely flew over my head. But returning to it with the kids I nannied and reading it aloud, I could like barely make it through without choking up at passages. And I found reading it to be a really dark and like tense experience.
That book also shares Dahl's propensity for just strange moments of surrealism and fancy in what is a fairly naturalistically written book.
And absurdly villainous adults, too. Just like, you know, total caricatures of nastiness, very much in the style of Trunchbull and her ilk.
So I guess what this podcast is saying is everyone should go out and read Holes. That's a pretty good book.
It's a very good book, and I think it's maybe more resonant than ever in the times that we're in. And it's also a very beautiful and lyrical book. I mean, I think everyone who is familiar with it remembers the song that Stanley's ancestors have to sing when they're washing the pig in the river, you know, and the lonely wolf howls to the moon. Right. That one's for all you Holes fans right. out if, there. I know you're listening.
If only, if only.
The woodpecker size. Yeah. Oh, I see. We can't not do it. It's that good.
You know, I didn't read that as a kid because it didn't exist when I was a kid, but I did read that to my kids.
No way.
So, yes, I am an old. Any last thoughts on Dahl and this crazy schizophrenic podcast of ours?
Oh, it's all interconnected, John. Just break out your index cards and your yarn and pin it up on your wall. You'll find that it's all interconnected. I think Roald Dahl's work is probably a great metaphor for who he was as a person. Just like a bundle of light and darkness and cynicism and optimism and weird prejudices and smart beliefs. He was, you know, a riddle wrapped in an enigma.
Yeah. And, you know, that's another important lesson we have as kids is when we learn that our heroes are flawed and sometimes very flawed.
Yeah, everyone has their come to Jesus moment with Roald Dahl. I think I was working on a book report about him for school and I was like, oh, yeesh, yikes, some of this is upsetting. But you should definitely check out Dead Authors podcast if you want to learn more about that. I mean, I think Roald Dahl exists in that gray area that his children's books characters don't.
Thanks to co-host Shannon Camp and to Zach Powers for the reading. You can hear both of them on the Stage of Fools podcast. You can mail me at sophomoreliterature@gmail.com. Or join the conversation on the Sophomore Lit Facebook page, or on the Incomparable membership Slack. Find more funny, smart podcasts at theincomparable.com. Keep up the reading, and remember, everything will be on the final.